The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Edward Gibbon, continued. Cassette 3, Side 2. Philip was alarmed. He dreaded lest the treason of the Mysian army should prove the first spark of a general conflagration. Distracted with the consciousness of his guilt and of his danger, he communicated the intelligence to the Senate. A gloomy silence prevailed, the effect of fear and perhaps of disaffection. Till at length Decius, one of the assembly, assuming a spirit worthy of his noble extraction, ventured to discover more intrepidity than the emperor seemed to possess. He treated the whole business with contempt, as a hasty and inconsiderate tumult, and Philip's rival as a phantom of royalty, who in a very few days would be destroyed by the same inconstancy that had created him. The speedy completion of the prophecy inspired Philip with a just esteem for so able a counsellor, and Decius appeared to him the only person capable of restoring peace and discipline to an army whose tumultuous spirit did not immediately subside after the murder of Marinus. Decius, who long resisted his own nomination, seems to have insinuated the danger of presenting a leader of merit to the angry and apprehensive minds of the soldiers, and his prediction was again confirmed by the event. The Legion of Mysia forced their judge to become, A.D. 249, their accomplice. They left him only the alternative of death or the purple. His subsequent conduct after that decisive measure was unavoidable. He conducted or followed his army to the confines of Italy, whither Philip, collecting all his forces to repel a formidable competitor whom he had raised up, advanced to meet him. The imperial troops were superior in number, but the rebels formed an army of veterans commanded by an able and experienced leader. Philip was either killed in the battle or put to death a few days afterwards at Verona. His son and associate in the empire was massacred at Rome by the Praetorian Guards, and the victorious Decius, with more favourable circumstances than the ambition of that age can usually plead, was universally acknowledged by the Senate and provinces. It is reported that immediately after his reluctant acceptance of the title of Augustus, he had assured Philip by a private message of his innocence and loyalty, solemnly protesting that on his arrival in Italy he would resign the imperial ornaments and return to the condition of an obedient subject. His professions might be sincere, but in the situation where fortune had placed him, it was scarcely possible that he could either forgive or be forgiven. The Emperor Decius had employed a few months in the works of peace and the administration of justice when, A.D. 250, he was summoned to the banks of the Danube by the invasion of the Goths. This is the first considerable occasion in which history mentions that great people, who afterwards broke the Roman power, sacked the capital, and reigned in Gaul, Spain, and Italy. So memorable was the part which they acted in the subversion of the Western Empire, that the name of Goths is frequently, but improperly, used as a general appellation of rude and warlike barbarism. In the beginning of the 6th century, and after the conquest of Italy, the Goths, in possession of present greatness, very naturally indulged themselves in the prospect of past and of future glory. They wished to preserve the memory of their ancestors, and to transmit to posterity their own achievements. The principal minister of the court of Ravenna, the learned Cassiodorus, gratified the inclination of the conquerors in a Gothic history, which consisted of 12 books, now reduced to the imperfect abridgment of Journand. These writers passed, with the most artful conciseness, over the misfortunes of the nation, celebrated its successful valour, and adorned the triumph with many Asiatic trophies that more properly belonged to the people of Scythia. On the faith of ancient songs, the uncertain but the only memorials of barbarians, they deduced the first origin of the Goths from the vast island or peninsula of Scandinavia. That extreme country of the north was not unknown to the conquerors of Italy. The ties of ancient consanguinity had been strengthened by recent offices of friendship, and a Scandinavian king had cheerfully abdicated his savage greatness that he might pass the remainder of his days in the peaceful and polished court of Ravenna. many vestiges which cannot be ascribed to the arts of popular vanity, attest the ancient residence of the Goths in the countries beyond the Baltic. From the time of the geographer Ptolemy, the southern part of Sweden seems to have continued in the possession of the less enterprising remnant of the nation, and a large territory is even at present divided into east and west, Gothland. During the Middle Ages, from the 9th to the 12th century, whilst Christianity was advancing with a slow progress into the north, the Goths and the Swedes composed two distinct and sometimes hostile members of the same monarchy. The latter of these two names has prevailed without extinguishing the former. The Swedes, who might well be satisfied with their own fame in arms, have in every age claimed the kindred glory of the Goths. In a moment of discontent against the court of Rome, Charles XII insinuated that his victorious troops were not degenerated from their brave ancestors who had already subdued the mistress of the world. If so many successive generations of Goths were capable of preserving a faint tradition of their Scandinavian origin, we must not expect from such unlettered barbarians any distinct account of the time and circumstances of their emigration. To cross the Baltic was an easy and natural attempt. The inhabitants of Sweden were masters of a sufficient number of large vessels with oars, and the distance is little more than 100 miles from Karlskrona to the nearest ports of Pomerania and Prussia. Here at length we land on firm and historic ground. At least as early as the Christian era, and as late as the age of the Antonines, the Goths were established towards the mouth of the Vistula, and in that fertile province where the commercial cities of Thorn, Elbing, Königsberg, and Danzig were long afterwards founded. Westward of the Goths, the numerous tribes of the Vandals were spread along the banks of the Oder and the sea coast of Pomerania and Mecklenburg. A striking resemblance of manners, complexion, religion, and language seemed to indicate that the Vandals and the Goths were originally one great people. The latter appear to have been subdivided into Ostrogoths, Visigoths, and Gepidae. The distinction among the Vandals was more strongly marked by the independent names of Heruli, Burgundians, Lombards, and a variety of other petty states, many of which in a future age expanded themselves into powerful monarchies. In the age of the Antonines, the Goths were still seated in Prussia. About the reign of Alexander Severus, the Roman province of Dacia had already experienced their proximity by frequent and destructive inroads. In this interval, therefore, of about 70 years, we must place the second migration of the Goths from the Baltic to the Euxine, but the cause that produced it lies concealed among the various motives which actuate the conduct of unsettled barbarians. Either a pestilence or a famine, a victory or a defeat, an oracle of the gods or the eloquence of a daring leader, was sufficient to impel the Gothic arms on the milder climates of the south. Besides the influence of a martial religion, the number and spirit of the Goths were equal to the most dangerous adventures. The use of round bucklers and short swords rendered them formidable in a close engagement. The manly obedience which they yielded to hereditary kings gave uncommon union and stability to their councils. And the renowned Amala, the hero of that age and the 10th ancestor of Theodoric, king of Italy, enforced by the ascendant of personal merit the prerogative of his birth, which he derived from the Anses, or demigods, of the Gothic nation. The fame of a great enterprise excited the bravest warriors from all the Vandalic states of Germany, many of whom are seen a few years afterwards combating under the common standard of the Goths. The first motions of the emigrants carried them to the banks of the Pripet, a river universally conceived by the ancients to be the southern branch of the Borysthenes, Dnieper. The windings of that great stream through the plains of Poland and Russia gave a direction to their line of march, and a constant supply of fresh water and pasturage to their numerous herds of cattle. They followed the unknown course of the river, confident in their valour, and careless of whatever power might oppose their progress. The Bastarnae and the Venedi were the first who presented themselves, and the flower of their youth, either from choice or compulsion, increased the Gothic army. The Bastarnae dwelt on the northern side of the Carpathian Mountains. The immense tract of land that separated the Bastarnae from the savages of Finland was possessed, or rather wasted, by the Venedi. We have some reason to believe that the first of these nations, which distinguished itself in the Macedonian War and was afterwards divided into the formidable tribes of the Pecuni, the Borani, the Carpi, etc., derived its origin from the Germans. With better authority, a Sarmatian extraction may be assigned to the Venedi, who rendered themselves so famous in the Middle Ages. But the confusion of blood and manners on the doubtful frontier often perplexed the most accurate observers. As the Goths advanced near the Euxine Sea, they encountered a purer race of Sarmatians, the Jazyges, the Alani, and the Roxolani, and they were probably the first Germans who saw the mouth of the Borysthenes and of the Tanais, Don. If we inquire into the characteristic marks of the people of Germany and of Sarmatia, we shall discover that those two great portions of humankind were principally distinguished by fixed huts or movable tents, by a close dress of flowing garments, by the marriage of one or of several wives, by a military force consisting for the most part either of infantry or cavalry, and above all by the use of the Teutonic or of the Sclavonian language, the last of which has been diffused by conquest from the confines of Italy to the neighbourhood of Japan. The Goths were now in possession of the Ukraine, a country of considerable extent and uncommon fertility, intersected with navigable rivers, which from either side discharged themselves into the Borysthenes, and interspersed with large and lofty forests of oaks. The plenty of game and fish, the innumerable beehives deposited in the hollows of old trees, and in the cavities of rocks, and forming, even in that rude age, a valuable branch of commerce, the size of the cattle, the temperature of the air, the aptness of the soil for every species of grain, and the luxuriancy of the vegetation, all displayed the liberality of nature and tempted the industry of man. But the Goths withstood all these temptations and still adhered to a life of idleness, of poverty, and of rapine. The Scythian hordes, which towards the east bordered on the new settlements of the Goths, presented nothing to their arms except the doubtful chance of an unprofitable victory. But the prospect of the Roman territories was far more alluring, and the fields of Dacia were covered with rich harvests, sown by the hands of an industrious, and exposed to be gathered by those of a warlike, people. It is probable that the conquests of Trajan, maintained by his successors less for any real advantage than for ideal dignity, had contributed to weaken the empire on that side. The new and unsettled province of Dacia was neither strong enough to resist, nor rich enough to satiate, the rapaciousness of the barbarians. As long as the remote banks of the Dniester were considered as the boundary of the Roman power, the fortifications of the lower Danube were more carelessly guarded, and the inhabitants of Mysia lived in supine security, fondly conceiving themselves at an inaccessible distance from any barbarian invaders. The eruption of the Goths under, that is, during, the reign of Philip, fatally convinced them of their mistake. The king, or leader, of that fierce nation, traversed with contempt the province of Dacia, and passed both the Dniester and the Danube, without encountering any opposition capable of retarding his progress. The relaxed discipline of the Roman troops betrayed the most important posts where they were stationed, and the fear of deserved punishment induced great numbers of them to enlist under the Gothic standard. The various multitude of barbarians appeared, at length, under the walls of Marcianopolis, a city built by Trajan in honour of his sister, and at that time the capital of the second Mysia. The inhabitants consented to ransom their lives and property by the payment of a large sum of money, and the invaders retreated back into their deserts, animated, rather than satisfied, with the first success of their arms against an opulent but feeble country. Intelligence was soon transmitted to the Emperor Decius that Cniva, king of the Goths, had passed the Danube a second time with more considerable forces, that his numerous detachments scattered devastation over the province of Mysia, whilst the main body of the army, consisting of 70,000 Germans and Sarmatians, a force equal to the most daring achievements, required the presence of the Roman monarch and the exertion of his military power. Decius found, AD 250, the Goths engaged before Nicopolis on the Jatrus, one of the many monuments of Trajan's victories. On his approach, they raised the siege, but with a design only of marching away to a conquest of greater importance, the siege of Philippopolis, a city of Thrace, founded by the father of Alexander, near the foot of Mount Hymus. Decius followed them through a difficult country and by forced marches. But when he imagined himself at a considerable distance from the rear of the Goths, Cniva turned with rapid fury on his pursuers. The camp of the Romans was surprised and pillaged, and for the first time their emperor fled in disorder, before a troop of half-armed barbarians. After a long resistance, Philippopolis, destitute of succor, was taken by storm. 100,000 persons are reported to have been massacred in the sack of that great city. Many prisoners of consequence became a valuable accession to the spoil, and Priscus, a brother of the late Emperor Philip, blushed not to assume the purple under the protection of the barbarous enemies of Rome. The time, however, consumed in that tedious siege, enabled Decius to revive the courage, restore the discipline, and recruit the numbers of his troops. He intercepted several parties of Carpi and other Germans, who were hastening to share the victory of their countrymen, entrusted the passes of the mountains to officers of approved valour and fidelity, repaired and strengthened the fortifications of the Danube, and exerted his utmost vigilance to oppose either the progress or the retreat of the Goths. Encouraged by the return of fortune, he anxiously waited for an opportunity to retrieve, by a great and decisive blow, his own glory and that of the Roman arms. At the same time, when Decius was struggling with the violence of the tempest, his mind, calm and deliberate amidst the tumult of war, investigated the more general causes that since the age of the Antonines had so impetuously urged the decline of the Roman greatness. He soon discovered that it was impossible to replace that greatness on a permanent basis without restoring public virtue, ancient principles and manners, and the oppressed majesty of the laws. To execute this noble but arduous design, he first resolved to revive the obsolete office of censor, an office which, as long as it had subsisted in its pristine integrity, had so much contributed to the perpetuity of the state, till it was usurped and gradually neglected by the Caesars. Conscious that the favour of the sovereign may confer power, but that the esteem of the people can alone bestow authority, he submitted the choice of the censor to the unbiased voice of the Senate. By their unanimous votes, or rather acclamations, Valerian, who was afterwards emperor and who then served with distinction in the army of Decius, was declared, AD 251, the 27th of October, the most worthy of that exalted honour. As soon as the decree of the Senate was transmitted to the emperor, he assembled a great council in his camp, and before the investiture of the censor-elect, he apprised him of the difficulty and importance of his great office. "Happy Valerian," said the prince to his distinguished subject, "happy in the general approbation of the Senate and of the Roman Republic. Accept the censorship of mankind, and judge of our manners. You will select those who deserve to continue members of the Senate. You will restore the equestrian order to its ancient splendor. You will improve the revenue, yet moderate the public burdens. You will distinguish into regular classes the various and infinite multitude of citizens, and accurately review the military strength, the wealth, the virtue, and the resources of Rome. Your decisions shall obtain the force of laws. The army, the palace, the ministers of justice, and the great officers of the empire are all subject to your tribunal. None is exempted, excepting only the ordinary consuls, the prefect of the city, the king of the sacrifices, and, as long as she preserves her chastity inviolate, the eldest of the Vestal Virgins. Even these few, who may not dread the severity, will anxiously solicit the esteem of the Roman censor. A magistrate invested with such extensive powers would have appeared not so much the minister as the colleague of his sovereign. Valerian justly dreaded an elevation so full of envy and of suspicion. He modestly urged the alarming greatness of the trust, his own insufficiency, and the incurable corruption of the times. He artfully insinuated that the office of censor was inseparable from the imperial dignity, and that the feeble hands of a subject were unequal to the support of such an immense weight of cares and of powers. The approaching event of war soon put an end to the prosecution of a project so specious but so impracticable, and whilst it preserved Valerian from the danger, it saved the Emperor Decius from the disappointment which would most probably have attended it. A censor may maintain, he can never restore, the morals of a state. It is impossible for such a magistrate to exert his authority with benefit, or even with effect, unless he is supported by a quick sense of honour and virtue in the minds of the people, by a decent reverence for the public opinion, and by a train of useful prejudices combating on the side of national manners. In a period when these principles are annihilated, the censorial jurisdiction must either sink into empty pageantry, or be converted into a partial instrument of vexatious oppression. It was easier to vanquish the Goths than to eradicate the public vices. Yet even in the first of these enterprises, Decius lost his army and his life. The Goths were now, on every side, surrounded and pursued by the Roman arms. The flower of their troops had perished in the long siege of Philippopolis, and the exhausted country could no longer afford subsistence for the remaining multitude of licentious barbarians. Reduced to this extremity, the Goths would gladly have purchased, by the surrender of all their booty and prisoners, the permission of an undisturbed retreat. But the emperor, confident of victory and resolving, by the chastisement of these invaders, to strike a salutary terror into the nations of the north, refused to listen to any terms of accommodation. The high-spirited barbarians preferred death to slavery. An obscure town of Mysia, called Forum Tenebronii, was the scene of the battle. The Gothic army was drawn up in three lines, and either from choice or accident, the front of the third line was covered by a morass. In the beginning of the action, the son of Decius, a youth of the fairest hopes and already associated to the honours of the purple, was slain by an arrow in the sight of his afflicted father, who, summoning all his fortitude, admonished the dismayed troops that the loss of a single soldier was of little importance to the Republic. The conflict was terrible. It was the combat of despair against grief and rage. The first line of the Goths at length gave way in disorder. The second, advancing to sustain it, shared its fate, and the third only remained entire, prepared to dispute the passage of the morass, which was imprudently attempted by the presumption of the enemy. Here the fortune of the day turned, and all things became adverse to the Romans, the place deep with ooze, sinking under those who stood, slippery to such as advanced, their armour heavy, the waters deep, nor could they wield, in that uneasy situation, their weighty javelins. The barbarians, on the contrary, were inured to encounters in the bogs, their persons tall, their spears long, such as could wound at a distance. In the morass, the Roman army, after an ineffectual struggle, was irrecoverably lost. nor could the body of the emperor ever be found. Such was the fate of Decius in the 50th year of his age, an accomplished prince, active in war and affable in peace, who, together with his son, has deserved to be compared, both in life and death, with the brightest examples of ancient virtue. This fatal blow humbled, for a very little time, the insolence of the legions. They appear to have patiently expected and submissively obeyed the decree of the Senate, which regulated the succession to the throne. From a just regard for the memory of Decius, the imperial title was conferred, AD 251, December, on Hostilianus, his only surviving son. But an equal rank, with more effectual power, was granted to Gallus, whose experience and ability seemed equal to the great trust of guardian to the young prince and the distressed empire. The first care of the new emperor was to deliver the Illyrian provinces from the intolerable weight of the victorious Goths. He, AD 252, consented to leave in their hands the rich fruits of their invasion, an immense booty, and, what was still more disgraceful, a great number of prisoners of the highest merit and quality. He plentifully supplied their camp with every conveniency that could assuage their angry spirits or facilitate their so much wished-for departure. And he even promised to pay them annually a large sum of gold, on condition they should never afterwards invest the Roman territories by their incursions. In the age of the Scipios, the most opulent kings of the earth, who courted the protection of the victorious commonwealth, were gratified with such trifling presents as could only derive a value from the hand that bestowed them. An ivory chair, a coarse garment of purple, an inconsiderable piece of plate, or a quantity of copper coin. After the wealth of nations had centred in Rome, the emperors displayed their greatness, and even their policy, by the regular exercise of a steady and moderate liberality towards the allies of the state. They relieved the poverty of the barbarians, honoured their merit, and recompensed their fidelity. These voluntary marks of bounty were understood to flow not from the fears, but merely from the generosity or the gratitude of the Romans. And whilst presents and subsidies were liberally distributed among friends and suppliants, they were sternly refused to such as claimed them as a debt. But this stipulation of an annual payment to a victorious enemy appeared without disguise in the light of an ignominious tribute. The minds of the Romans were not yet accustomed to accept such unequal laws from a tribe of barbarians. And the prince, who, by a necessary concession, had probably saved his country, became the object of the general contempt and aversion. The death of Hostilianus, though it happened in the midst of a raging pestilence, was interpreted as the personal crime of Gallus, and even the defeat of the late emperor was ascribed by the voice of suspicion to the perfidious counsels of his hated successor. The tranquillity which the empire enjoyed during the first year of his administration served rather to inflame than to appease the public discontent, and as soon as the apprehensions of war were removed, the infamy of the peace was more deeply and more sensibly felt. But the Romans were irritated to a still higher degree when they discovered that they had not even secured their repose, though at the expense of their honour. The dangerous secret of the wealth and weakness of the empire had been revealed to the world. New swarms of barbarians encouraged, AD 253, by the success, and not conceiving themselves bound by the obligation of their brethren, spread devastation through the Illyrian provinces and terror as far as the gates of Rome. The defense of the monarchy, which seemed abandoned by the pusillanimous emperor, was assumed by Aemilianus, governor of Pannonia and Mysia, who rallied the scattered forces and revived the fainting spirits of the troops. The barbarians were unexpectedly attacked, routed, chased, and pursued beyond the Danube. The victorious leader distributed as a donative the money collected for the tribute, and the acclamations of the soldiers proclaimed him emperor on the field of battle. Gallus, who, careless of the general welfare, indulged himself in the pleasures of Italy, was almost in the same instant informed of the success of the revolt and of the rapid approach of his aspiring lieutenant. He advanced to meet him as far as the plains of Spoleto. When the armies came in sight of each other, the soldiers of Gallus compared the ignominious conduct of their sovereign with the glory of his rival. They admired the valour of Aemilianus. They were attracted by his liberality, for he offered a considerable increase of pay to all deserters. The murder of Gallus and of his son Volusianus put an end to the civil war, and the Senate, A.D. 253, May, gave a legal sanction to the rights of conquest. The letters of Aemilianus to that assembly displayed a mixture of moderation and vanity. He assured them that he should resign to their wisdom the civil administration, and contenting himself with the quality of their general, would in a short time assert the glory of Rome and deliver the empire from all the barbarians, both of the north and of the east. His pride was flattered by the applause of the Senate, and medals are still extant, representing him with the name and attributes of Hercules and Victor, and of Mars the Avenger. If the new monarch possessed the abilities, he wanted the time necessary to fulfil these splendid promises. Less than 4 months intervened between his victory and his fall. He had vanquished Gallus. He sank under the weight of a competitor more formidable than Gallus. That unfortunate prince had sent Valerian, already distinguished by the honourable title of censor, to bring the legions of Gaul and Germany to his aid. Valerian executed that commission with zeal and fidelity, and as he arrived too late to save his sovereign, he resolved to revenge him. The troops of Aemilianus, who still lay encamped in the plains of Spoleto, were awed by the sanctity of his character, but much more by the superior strength of his army. And as they were now become as incapable of personal attachment as they had always been of constitutional principle, they, A.D. 253, August, readily imbrued their hands in the blood of a prince who had so lately been the object of their partial choice. The guilt was theirs, but the advantage of it was Valerian's, who obtained the possession of the throne by the means, indeed, of a civil war, but with a degree of innocence singular in that age of revolutions, since he owned neither gratitude nor allegiance to his predecessor whom he dethroned. Valerian was about 60 years of age when he was invested with the purple, not by the caprice of the populace or the clamours of the army, but by the unanimous voice of the Roman world. In his gradual ascent through the honours of the state, he had deserved the favour of virtuous princes, and had declared himself the enemy of tyrants. His noble birth, his mild but unblemished manners, his learning, prudence, and experience, were revered by the Senate and people. And if mankind, according to the observation of an ancient writer, had been left at liberty to choose a master, their choice would most assuredly have fallen on Valerian. Perhaps the merit of this emperor was inadequate to his reputation. Perhaps his abilities, or at least his spirit, were affected by the languor and coldness of old age. The consciousness of his decline engaged him to share the throne with a younger and more active associate. The emergency of the times demanded a general no less than a prince, and the experience of the Roman censor might have directed him where to bestow the imperial purple, as the reward of military merit. But instead of making a judicious choice, which would have confirmed his reign and endeared his memory, Valerian, consulting only the dictates of affection or vanity, immediately invested with the supreme honours his son Gallienus, a youth whose effeminate vices had been hitherto concealed by the obscurity of a private station. The joint government of the father and the son subsisted about 7, and the sole administration of Gallienus continued about 8 years, A.D. 253-268. But the whole period was one uninterrupted series of confusion and calamity. as the Roman Empire was at the same time, and on every side, attacked by the blind fury of foreign invaders and the wild ambition of domestic usurpers. We shall consult order and perspicuity by pursuing not so much the doubtful arrangement of dates as the more natural distribution of subjects. The most dangerous enemies of Rome during the reigns of Valerian and Gallienus were 1. The Franks, 2. The Alemanni, 3. The Goths, and 4. The Persians. Under these general appellations we may comprehend the adventures of less considerable tribes, whose obscure and uncouth names would only serve to oppress the memory and perplex the attention of the reader. 1. The Franks. As the posterity of the Franks compose one of the greatest and most enlightened nations of Europe, the powers of learning and ingenuity have been exhausted in the discovery of their unlettered ancestors. To the tales of credulity have succeeded the systems of fancy. Every passage has been sifted, every spot has been surveyed, that might possibly reveal some faint traces of their origin. It has been supposed that Pannonia, that Gaul, that the northern parts of Germany gave birth to that celebrated colony of warriors. At length the most rational critics, rejecting the fictitious emigrations of ideal conquerors, have acquiesced in a sentiment whose simplicity persuades us of its truth. They suppose that, about the year 240, a new confederacy was formed, under the name of Franks, by the old inhabitants of the Lower Rhine and the Weser. The present circle of Westphalia, the Landgraviate of Hesse, and the duchies of Brunswick and Lüneburg were the ancient seat of the Chauci, who in their inaccessible morasses defied the Roman arms, of the Cherusci, proud of the fame of Arminius, of the Catti, formidable by their firm and intrepid infantry, and of several other tribes of inferior power and renown. The love of liberty was the ruling passion of these Germans, the enjoyment of it their best treasure, the word that expressed that enjoyment the most pleasing to their ear. They deserved, they assumed, they maintained the honourable epithet of Franks or Freemen, which concealed, though it did not extinguish, the peculiar names of the several states of the Confederacy. Tacit consent and mutual advantage dictated the first laws of the Union. It was gradually cemented by habit and experience. The League of the Franks may admit of some comparison with the Helvetic body, in which every canton, retaining its independent sovereignty, consults with its brethren in the common cause without acknowledging the authority of any supreme head or representative assembly. But the principle of the two confederacies were extremely different. A peace of 200 years has rewarded the wise and honest policy of the Swiss. An inconstant spirit, the thirst of rapine, and a disregard to the most solemn treaties disgraced the character of the Franks. The Romans had long experienced the daring valour of the people of Lower Germany. The union of their strength threatened Gaul with a more formidable invasion, and required the presence of Gallienus, the heir and colleague of imperial power. Whilst that prince and his infant son Salonius displayed in the court of Treves the majesty of the empire, its armies were ably conducted by their general Posthumus, who, though he afterwards betrayed the family of Valerian, was ever faithful for the great interest of the monarchy. The treacherous language of panegyrics and medals darkly announces a long series of victories. Trophies and titles attest, if such evidence can attest, the fame of Posthumus, who is repeatedly styled the conqueror of the Germans and the saviour of Gaul. But a single fact, the only one, indeed, of which we have any distinct knowledge, erases in a great measure these monuments of vanity and adulation. The Rhine, though dignified with the title of safeguard of the provinces, was an imperfect barrier against the daring spirit of enterprise with which the Franks were actuated. Their rapid devastation stretched from the river to the foot of the Pyrenees, nor were they stopped by those mountains. Spain, which had never dreaded, was unable to resist the inroads of the Germans. During 12 years, the greatest part of the region of Gallienus, that opulent country, was the theatre of unequal and destructive hostilities. Tarragona, the flourishing capital of a peaceful province, was sacked and almost destroyed. And so late as the days of Orosius, who wrote in the 5th century, wretched cottages scattered amidst the ruins of magnificent cities still recorded the rage of the barbarians. When the exhausted country no longer supplied a variety of plunder, the Franks seized on some vessels in the ports of Spain and transported themselves into Mauritania. The distant province was astonished with the fury of these barbarians, who seemed to fall from a new world, as their name, manners, and complexion were equally unknown on the coast of Africa. 2. The Alemanni. In that part of Upper Saxony beyond the Elbe, which is at present called the Marquisate of Lusas, there existed in ancient times a sacred wood, the awful seat of the superstition of the Suevi. This book is continued on Cassette 4, Side 1.